Now, like I said, I believe that Daniel is a very, very, very important book because for a number of reasons. One of the things we have to understand in those cultures, when a kingdom or when a king would conquer nations, like for example, Nebuchadnezzar goes in and he conquered Judah, right? The ideas, the mindset wasn't simply that the nation itself or the army of the conquering nation conquered the foe. It was that the gods of those nations conquered the gods of the conquered nations. In other words, when Babylon conquered Judah, Bel, the god of the Babylonians, or Marduk, the god of the Babylonians, was considered more powerful than Yahweh, than Jehovah. So there's a problem. Jehovah, or the Lord, has to do something to assure Daniel and the rest of the nations he's not less powerful. In fact, he's the only God who exists, right? So I think that's part of the reason we have so much information in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapters 9 through 12. Daniel chapters 10 through 12 are actually just one vision, but we're going to talk. We'll talk a little bit about that, and some of this we went through in a men's Bible study a while back. So I give you there on those sheets, on these worksheets, I give you quite a bit of information about that, especially about Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. We'll mention a few things on there. But I give you some details on that, and so that's for you to look at. Do you understand also there are several unique things about the book of Daniel. One of the unique things about the book of Daniel is that it was written in two languages. You know that? Did you know that? Daniel was written in two languages, Hebrew and Aramaic. Okay? Daniel chapter 1, all the way through chapter 2, the first part of verse 4 was written in Hebrew. All of a sudden, at the end of verse 4, all the way through, I believe it was chapter 7, verse 28, was written in Aramaic. And then from that point on, it's written in Hebrew again. Why would God do that? Well, the answer, this answer makes so much sense to me. Daniel chapter 2, verse 4, on through chapter 7, verse 28, is written to the Gentile nations and about the Gentile nations. So God is using Daniel to communicate this message to the Gentile nations. And that's exactly what Daniel does. Remember, let's walk through this a little bit, and I think you can see this. In Daniel chapter 1, don't look at your sheets. See if you can do this by memory. In Daniel chapter 1, what's the message of, or what's the thrust of Daniel chapter 1? What? He's taken into captivity, and he is told that they are told they have to eat the king's meat. Daniel refuses. And so you have him, you know, Daniel refusing to eat the king's meat, Daniel taken into captivity. It's chapter 1. Chapter 2, what happens in chapter 2? That's one chapter ahead. No, that's fine. The vision of the statue, chapter 2. Chapter 3, Cheryl already answered that, the fiery furnace. Chapter 4, see how fast you can move through Daniel? This is really easy. We're already in chapter 4. What is chapter 4? Nebuchadnezzar's vision of dream of the big tree and his 7 years of madness. Daniel chapter 5. Handwriting on the wall. Daniel chapter 6. Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel chapter 7. Daniel receives a vision of four beasts, right? The lion, the bear, the leopard, and the indescribable beast, all right? Daniel chapter 8, another vision, the ram and the he-goat. Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's prayer and the vision of the 70 weeks, right? Daniel chapters 10 through 12, the final vision. See how fast you can move through Daniel? I mean, it's really, really a very, very easy book to move through, but it is so strategically important that Daniel is given this information in Aramaic to communicate to the nations of the world. Then, in Daniel chapter 8, through the end of the book, what's that about? Or to whom is Daniel concerned there? Daniel chapter 8. Starting in Daniel chapter 8, you have him focusing back on the Hebrews. He goes back to, this is what's going to happen. I'm concerned, Daniel's saying, I'm concerned about my own people. So I need to know what's going to happen there. So God returns to writing in Hebrew. And if you remember, a great illustration of this, I think, is Daniel chapter 9. Daniel praying to God. And he realizes that he's coming to the end of the 70-year captivity. He's been reading in the book of Jeremiah. He says that in chapter 9. And he says, what's going to happen now? Now that the 70-year captivity is coming to an end, what's going to happen now? So God gives him the vision of the 70 weeks or the 490-year time frame that God has set up. Because I think Daniel had in mind that, okay, The 70-year captivity is coming to an end. We're going to return to the land. Are you going to establish the kingdom now? And God answers him and says, no, there's going to be a 490-year time span that I have. And 483 years are going to be fulfilled, and then Messiah is going to come. And Messiah will come and present himself. And that's exactly what we find. That's why all of this is so important to understand in terms of the time frame. You know, there's an interesting discussion that goes on about people who reject the book of Daniel. Why do they reject the book of Daniel? Well, basically, there are four reasons. Number one, because predictive prophecy is too specific. You read Daniel chapter 11, and like I said last week, those first 35 verses contain over 130 prophecies that have already been fulfilled. There is no way a mortal human being could do that. You know what I say? You're right. No mortal could do that. But God revealed it to Daniel. And that's what Daniel says in chapter 2. You know, Nebuchadnezzar says, well, can you do this and can you reveal this dream? And Daniel says, no man can. But there is a God in heaven who can. And God did it in chapter 2, and God did it in chapter 4, and God did it in chapter 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 through 12. The same God that revealed what he did in Daniel chapter 2 is the same God who revealed all the details in chapter 11. I mean, they say predictive prophecy is too specific. And my answer is, who says so? They reject prophecy because they claim the prophecies are too precise. So they had to have been written after the fact. And that's what they do. With the book of Daniel, they will tell us that the book of Daniel could not possibly have been written during Daniel's lifetime. It had to be some imposter. And it used to be that these critics would say that the book of Daniel was actually written in the first century, about the same time as the New Testament epistles and the rest of the New Testament. And then something happened. In 1948... the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you know what they found among the Dead Sea Scrolls? Copies of the book of Daniel. Copies of the book of Daniel that were written hundreds of years before the New Testament. So what do you do then? you would expect them to say, well, you know, that's then the book of Daniel was written, you know, when we believe it was. No, they won't do that. See, what these people are, they are, do you understand why prophecy, this is what I think. I think prophecy is so important because it illustrates the omniscience of God, that God is all-knowing. I mean, listen to the details. Read through Daniel chapter 11 and listen to those details. Don't get bogged down in trying to identify, you know, the king of the north, the king of the south, the daughter, the ships of Shittim, and all of that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But God is demonstrating his omniscience. I mean, this is when you read the book of Daniel, I think God is like a big muscular guy on a beach who's walking along and he's just kicking sand in the face of all the pretender gods. And that's what Isaiah tells us. You want to know what kind of God I am? I'm the kind of God who can declare what's in the future, down to the detail. I can name the name of the king who will bring my people back to my land. That's the kind of God that gave the revelation of the book of Daniel. I mean, the other thing is the so-called miracles are childish. I mean, you know, Daniel chapter 1, you have miracles upon, you have miracle upon miracle upon miracle. The children of Israel, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, and Daniel, refused to eat the king's meat. What happens? I love this. This is great. Look what it says. This is so opposite of, where is it here? Melzar took away the portion, verse 16. As for these children, God gave them knowledge and skill. In verse 14, he consented to them. At the end of 10 days, verse 15, that's what I want. At the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh. We live in California, right? In California, the standard is to be smelt and tan and lean and mean. The biblical standard is pale and chubby. That's what it says. I mean, that's what it says right here. Pale and chubby. Fairer and fatter, right? I'm kidding. I mean, there's just, you know. How did that happen? They're eating this strict. How did that happen? You cannot explain it any other way other than God. Secondly, you know, you look at some other miracles in the book of Daniel. Three Hebrews get tossed into a fiery furnace. What happened to them? Not a thing. In fact, the smell of smoke didn't even come on their bodies. I mean, my wife has forbidden me from now on, and a number of you have also forbidden me from grilling. I'm no longer allowed to grill because the way I cook my meat, I like it well done. And that's not the way to cook meat out here in California. It's not the way to cook meat anywhere, I guess, but I like it that way. But anyway, when you stand next to a grill, you smell like smoke or fire. I mean, these people, these men were thrown into the midst of a... I mean, you would think, according to what Daniel chapter 3 tells us, the men who took them up there fell into the fire and were burned, incinerated instantaneously. These men, these three Hebrews, didn't have anything on them. And in fact, Nebuchadnezzar says, didn't we throw three of them in? And I see four. And the fourth one I see is like the Son of God. And I believe that was a pre-incarnate Christ. It's fascinating when you read the account, Nebuchadnezzar has the fire heated three or seven times hotter, which means it is extraordinarily bright. But he sees this fourth being walking around in the fire what is it about the fourth being that set him off and that made him, that distinguished him and that made Nebuchadnezzar say, well, he's like the Son of God? I think it was his brightness. I think this fourth character, this fourth person in the fire was so bright, it stuck out to Nebuchadnezzar. He knew. You have Daniel chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall. Which, you know, I mean, think about that. Here is a bodiless hand that comes out of nowhere and writes three words up on the wall. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And nobody knows what it means. Where did that hand come from? I mean, it was a miracle. Daniel chapter 6, you have Daniel thrown into a den of lions. What happens to those lions? God shut the mouth. Daniel says, God shut the mouth of the lions. I mean, and then when the men who conspired against Daniel are thrown, I mean, they don't even make it to the bottom of the pit. They don't even make it to the floor. And the lions just are ravenous on them and kill them. What caused that? God sent his angel to, or God came and closed the mouth of the lions. If and then you have all these prophecies. If you are a critic, if you are an unbeliever, and you have all of these miracles, and you have all of these prophecies in Daniel, what do you think? I mean, how do you handle the book of Daniel? Because prophecy is given to show the omniscience of God. Miracles are given to show the omnipotence of God, the power of God. God can overcome. God is just telling us he can overcome anything. I mean, that's what the Hebrews said, right, in chapter 3. Our God can deliver us from this fire. But if he won't, that doesn't matter to us. We're going to serve our God. And we're going to talk about that in Hebrews this morning. The determination to serve God. It's what they do, they simply deny the personal God. They simply deny the existence of a personal, true, and living God. In Daniel chapter 3, you have another thing. In Daniel chapter 3, you have a list of instruments. And this is what they say about this, that these in this list of instruments, there are three of the instruments that are listed that are Greek words. Okay? So that proves that it was written during the Greek or Roman period. I mean, this just infuriates me. It really does. This just really gets me. My answer to the presence of three Greek words in the list of instruments is this: so what? It proves nothing as far as the date of the book is concerned. It says, Greek language existed before Alexander the Great came along, okay? I mean, did English exist before America? I mean, it's silly, okay? The use of Greek words borrowed from one language, the use of words borrowed from one language to another. Well, I'm going to talk about it in the sermon this morning. You know, we use a Greek term, we use a term in our language that's based on a Greek term that was used thousands of years before we came around. It's the word sympathy. You know, it's based on that word sympathy is based on a Greek word. So that proves what? Nothing. That we borrow words from languages all the time. I mean, I honestly get so angry about this because I think this is such, it's just rank unbelief. I don't want to believe what the Bible says. So I'm going to look for all these reasons that I can deny the Bible. And then the last one is this, you know, the book of Daniel is historically inaccurate. It's full of inaccuracies. One of the big ones actually came in Daniel chapter 5. And if you look there, in the very first verse, you'll read about a man, Belshazzar, king. The king made a great feast. All through history, all through history, you will not find information about a man named Belshazzar. There's none. We just don't, there's nothing about this guy. So the critics all said, well, you know, there it is. There's an error. Daniel, this author of the book of Daniel, he didn't know what he was talking about. Not a clue. In the early part of the 20th century, there was a discovery made of a chronicle called the Nabonidus Chronicle. Nabonidus was a ruler in Babylon. If you go back in history, if you read Greek history and Roman history, if you read, you know, even up into the early 20th century history books, you find the last ruler of Babylon that we knew of was a man by the name of Nabonidus. Nabonidus hated ruling. I mean, he hated it. He hated administrative work. He hated it with a passion. He didn't want to be the ruler in Babylon. He didn't. According to the Nabonidus Chronicle, he hated it so much. We know Nabonidus wrote this. According to the Nabonidus Chronicle, he left the city of Babylon and moved to a little place called, a little kind of an oasis out in the desert called Timnah. And he lived out there. And guess what he did? He left the city of Babylon under the charge of his son, Belshazzar. He says that. He tells us that in the chronicle. Now we have an answer. So you would expect the critics, the unbelieving scholars, to say, okay, well, we admit the Bible's... No, that's not what happens. They go to Daniel chapter 6, and they say, we don't know who Darius is. And see, there's just no integrity in unbelief. It's just one thing after another. We know who these people are now, and we can give an answer to the critics. So one of the things people criticize is this. There, in Daniel chapter 6, you have something happened in chapter 5. Remember that? What happened in chapter 5 to Babylon? The Babylonian Empire comes to an end. Who takes over? The Medes and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians hated the Babylonians, and they conquered Babylon. One of the fascinating things, and one of the things I've always wondered about is this. How is it that Daniel was able to stay in power when Medo-Persia conquered Babylon? You ever wonder that? I mean, Daniel is a high-ranking official in the Babylonian government, right? So how is it that when the Medes and the Persians come in, they killed everybody? I mean, they just slaughtered everybody. So how is it Daniel gets to live? Well, I think that's part of it. I think Daniel was so well known in world affairs. I think the nations around them, including the Medes and the Persians, had such a high regard for this man Daniel. They knew his integrity. They knew his honesty. I mean, read chapter 1. Read chapter 2. Read chapter 4. Read chapter 5. I mean, honestly, I think the fame of Daniel was worldwide. And so he was able, I think Darius the Mede knew Daniel, and he was determined, I'm going to keep this guy in power. I'm going to keep this guy because I can benefit from him. I mean, that makes sense to me. And I think Daniel's integrity and his willingness to serve whoever is in power. I mean, isn't it interesting? I think Pastor Matt pointed this out a couple of weeks ago. Isn't it interesting when the Chaldeans couldn't interpret the dream in Daniel chapter 2? Daniel doesn't say to the king, now's our opportunity to get rid of these scoundrels. Let's wipe them out, and you put me in power. You keep me in place, and I'll help you. Daniel doesn't say that. I think that speaks volumes of Daniel's personal integrity and concern for lost people. Let's move into this. We got 15 minutes to go through chapters 8 and 11. In chapter 8, and I give you this, he saw a vision of a ram. We're not going to read all of chapter 8, but I do want to look at it. In the third year of the reign of the king Belshazzar, that's 549, about 549, 550, 549 BC, King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which had appeared to me at the first. What was the first vision that Daniel had seen? Chapter 7, 552, okay? Because he doesn't say, I'm speaking here now about the visions that were exclusively shown to Daniel, okay? These are visions that are given strictly to Daniel, Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8. A ram charged westward. He says, I saw the vision. It came to pass. I was in Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. I saw in a vision, I was by the river Ulai. And I lifted up my eyes, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high. When you run across things like descriptions like the terms horns, those speak of something, okay? There are several men in here who have hunted in the past, or maybe you hunt now. And when you go deer hunting, you bag a deer. And when the deer has a big set of horns, what does that mean about the deer? He's older, he's powerful, he's got authority. That's what he's talking about here. These horns speak of power, the power and authority of this ram, of the ram. Had two horns. The two horns were high. One was higher than the other. We can talk about that. The higher came up last. I think that's speaking of the Persian Empire, because the Medes came up first. The Medes, don't have time to get into it, but the Persian Empire came on stronger than the Median Empire, and I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. No beast could stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. He did according to his will. He became great, considering there was a goat that came from the west on the face of the whole earth, touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. So you have a unicorn goat coming along, and he smashes into the ram, and then he tramples the ram in fury. I love this. I think it's in the fury of his power, verse 6. He came close to the ram. He was moved with what's choler? Anger, fury, hatred. It is fascinating to me. This just to cut to the chase with all this. The ram was the Medes and the Persians. The goat was the emperor Alexander the Great. Alexander hated the Medes and the Persians. Do you know why? Because his father, Philip of Macedon, tried to battle the Medes and the Persians, and Philip was defeated by the Medes and the Persians. Alexander had such a hatred for the Medes and the Persians. This is such a great description of what he did. He was moved with choler against him, and he smote the ram and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. Alexander, he is a fascinating historical character. He was, and I talked about this last week, he tried to spread Greek philosophy all over the world for a time, for a certain period of time. When he went to the East, when he went to places like India, he became fascinated with Eastern culture. And I mentioned this last week. Who was Alexander's tutor? Aristotle had such an influence on Alexander. But when Alexander became enamored with Greek culture, with Eastern culture, Aristotle repudiated him, said, I don't want to have anything to do with him. Alexander continued his military conquest, and he conquered Tyre, and he starts going down south, and he's going through a little land called Israel, and he gets to the city of Jerusalem, and he stops. There's a story about this that's just really interesting. I got to tell you, this is not Bible. This is not apocalyptic. It's somewhat apocryphal. But Josephus tells us that when Alexander and his generals came to Jerusalem, Alexander is met at the city gates of Jerusalem by some men, by some leaders of the Jewish faith, who go out to the gate and they meet Alexander, and Alexander gets off his horse and walks over to these men and has a conversation with them. And he goes back and he says, you know, we're not going to impose Greek philosophy and we're not going to impose our Greek religions on them. We're going to move on. And historians wonder why. Why did that happen? Maybe you've heard this story before or something like this. People say that Josephus tells us that when Alexander came to Jerusalem, the priests walked out of the city and showed him this passage from the book of Daniel. And they said, this is you fulfilling this. And Alexander's generals said, you know, what are you doing? And Alexander says to them, you know, I had a dream. And in my dream, I saw these men standing before this gate, standing in the attire that they're wearing. And they told me and they showed me I'm in their holy books. I'm not in the holy books of my religion, but I'm in the holy books of their religion. And Alexander basically left them alone. He conquered Israel, but he goes on down to Egypt and conquered them. Now, here's the thing. I think they went through chapter 8, verse 7. I don't think that they went into chapter 8, verse 8, because look what that says. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. I don't think they went that far. I think they stopped. Because you're not going to tell a conqueror, oh, you're going to conquer all these lands, but you're going to die. But that's what happened. Alexander, 33 years old, Alexander dies. And the kingdom, his kingdom, his empire is broken up among four of his generals. Well, that's essentially what, and I give you there the generals. The two that are really interesting are the last two, Seleucus and Ptolemy. The P is silent, Ptolemy. They become instrumental. They become the kings of the north and the king of the south. And that's what Daniel chapter 11 is all about. Daniel chapter 11 is, have you ever read that? I mean, have you ever gone through that and read the king of the north, the king of the south, the daughter, the, you know, all of that? That is that easy to follow? I think I compare it sometimes to the genealogies. It's really hard to follow. But historians have been able to work it out. And I give you there the names of some of those, the king of the north and the king of the south. The main one, and we'll look at this, the main one that I want you to see is found beginning in chapter 11, verse 20, I think it is. Go down to verse 21 of chapter 11. You have this one, I'm in verse 31, no wonder. Okay, verse 21, it says, and in his state shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom with flatteries. That was a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was a vile, vile, wicked, wicked man. Daniel chapter 8 talks about him as well. And I think God, what God is doing in these two chapters, he is so concerned for people to understand the character of an end-time person that we call the Antichrist, that we call the beast, that we call the man of sin, that Daniel called the little horn in chapter 7. I think God is so anxious for people to understand how wicked and how evil and how perverse that this end-time person will be, that he gives us a historical example, a historical illustration. And that illustration is Antiochus Epiphanes. And you can read about him, and I said this last week, it's not Bible, but you can read about him in a couple of places. The first book of Maccabees, you can read about him in the history book of Josephus. Josephus talks about him. You look at what he does. It says he will stand. There will stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Antiochus did not inherit his realm. Antiochus stole it. Antiochus came in and through subtlety and deceit and trickery, he usurped the kingdom. And he ruled, he was the king of the north. He was the king of Syria, okay? He ruled Israel. He ruled that realm. In verses 21 down through 35, you have the discussion is about Antiochus. In verse 22, it says, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. In verse 22, it's talking about Antiochus having victories. He goes down to Egypt, and he conquers Egypt. He conquers the king of the south. He has military victories in Egypt. When it talks about the prince of the covenant, it's probably talking about the high priest. That's what he's talking about back in chapter 8, verse 11, the prince of the covenant. So he overcomes, and this is just, it's not, it's complex, and that's why I give you the notes, I give you some of the information there about these. Go down to verse 30. Look at this. In verse 30, it says, I mentioned this earlier, the ships of Shittim, for the ships of Shittim shall come against him. Antiochus had gone to war in Egypt, and the Egyptian rulers had gotten so tired of him coming down there and fighting them that they appealed to a little empire way off in the west that was just kind of an upstart empire called Rome. And Rome decided they were going to help the rulers of Egypt with this Antiochus, so they send their navy down. And when it talks about ships of Shittim, it's talking about ships coming from the west. So this Roman garrison, this Roman navy is coming down, and they're helping, a fleet of Roman ships coming down to help these two brothers in Egypt. Well, they sent one of their emissaries to Antiochus, and they drew a circle around him, and literally they drew a circle around him in the sand, and they said, "You step out of that circle and you're done." He was so mad, he got turned back from Egypt. He was so mad, he went back up through Israel, and he starts all of this persecution, horrible, horrible persecution of the Jewish people. He sacrifices a pig on the altar. He puts a statue of Zeus on the altar of burnt offering. He burns copies of the Torah, the Old Testament law. He starts hunting down Jews, kills thousands of them, has thousands of them murdered. All of a sudden, there's this rebellion against him. A man by the name of Mattathias Maccabees and his five sons begin rebelling against him. We call that today the Maccabean Revolt or the Hasmonean Revolt. That's important because later in John, they celebrate that. They celebrate the Maccabean Revolt, the Feast of Dedication. That's what John chapter 10 is about when Jesus stands up at the Feast of Dedication. He's looking back at the Hasmonean Revolt. Anyway, to say that the whole point I'm trying to get, if you don't get anything else, get this. The whole point of this is this. The 400 silent years were not silent. God was working, and God had foretold all of these events in advance of them occurring. God was active, and he protected his people. He protected the Jews. He watched over them. He made sure that they weren't wiped out. Antiochus was determined to wipe them out. And God was determined to preserve them. And so what the book of Daniel simply tells us, God is going to be faithful to his word. He's going to keep his word. We can rest assured in that. Anyway, I've gone over a little bit. Sorry, apologize, but enjoy your refreshments, and we'll meet back in here. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, thank you for our time together this morning. Thank you for the day you've given us, for the hope and the promise of eternal life. In Jesus' name, amen.